Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We all know the name of the Kennedys very, very well, and most of us have some fairly thorough knowledge of at least the reputation of that important American family. But within the Kennedy family, dynasty, clan, whatever you want to say, are individual stories that are not nearly so well known. And I am so thrilled that best-selling author Barbara Leeming has taken the time to thoroughly tell one of the most intriguing stories within the Kennedy family, that of Kathleen Kennedy, nicknamed Kick. Kick Kennedy was a vibrant daughter of Joe and Rose Kennedy, and her own particular story was, on the one hand, exuberant and joyous, and also tinged with tragedy. And her story of coming to age also occurred largely in England on the eve of the Second World War. And those were such turbulent times for Britain and really the whole world, confronting the looming threat of Hitler and the Nazis. And so Barbara Leeming has not only told us the story of who Kathleen Kick Kennedy was, but also of what it was like for her and her closest friends to live when and where they did, and to confront this really frightening moment in our history. It's a story that is so intriguing and inspiring. Barbara Leeming has written about all kinds of important people before this, including a very highly regarded biography of Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy Onassis. Also, she has written about Winston Churchill, Marilyn Monroe, Catherine Hepburn, Betty Davis, Rita Hayward, Orson Welles, from right here in Kenosha. So she has is a highly regarded author many times over. This latest book is published by Thomas Dunn Books, a division of St. Martin's. Again, it is called Kick Kennedy, The Charmed Life and Tragic Death of the Favorite Kennedy Daughter. And Barbara Leeming, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much for coming, for letting me come to talk to you about this. It's been an extraordinary experience to do this book, and it is something that, as you said, is a very strange kind of story, because, I mean, most people don't know the name Kick Kennedy, and I don't think that's so strange, for the simple reason that she was somebody who died in a plane crash when she was just 28 years old. But what fascinated me about it initially was that she was President Kennedy's favorite sister. And as one of their friends said to me, she was Jack's psychological twin. And what they meant by that was this: she's very much like Jack in the sense that she was wildly ambitious. She was somebody who desperately, desperately wanted to be a person of influence. I mean, she wanted power, and so did Jack. You know, I wrote a biography of President Kennedy, and I know him like the back of my hand. And when I started to think about Kick, I thought there are tremendous, tremendous resemblances between them. But both of them were brought up in a family, the Kennedy family, in which old Joe Kennedy had taught the kids a big lesson, and that was that they were supposed to think of themselves as a unit. They were supposed to be the Kennedys, rather than thinking of themselves as individuals. And for Jack, interestingly, that really was not a problem, because his ego was satisfied by becoming the top Kennedy. I mean, he fought his way past his older brother, and he became the Kennedy. But for a girl, that was never going to happen, even though Kick was by all accounts the favorite child of the Kennedys. Girls in the Kennedy family didn't become the top dogs. And this is somebody who desperately wanted an identity in her own right. And so as a result, she had to find it someplace else. But she had to find it someplace that was overwhelmingly attractive and powerful in its own right. And she did it at the age of 18. I mean, what was so interesting was that when her father, Joe Kennedy, went to England as the U.S. ambassador to the court of St. James in 1938, Kick went along with him. And when she got there, she saw her opening, and she found her identity, as you were talking about earlier, in the British aristocracy, the highest levels of, in the most closed world imaginable. Suddenly, there's this little Irish Catholic girl from Boston who is the star of the British aristocracy. And as a result, what you have here is by no means a typical Kennedy story. It's very much Kick's story takes us instead into a whole other world, and that is, it's really very much a story that takes place within the British aristocracy, and as you said, at a time of tumultuous change. This was the moment when, and this Kick did not understand, it was the moment when the power, the political power of the British aristocracy was in its final stages. It was about to vanish forever, as it did, of course, in 1945. And so what I realized was that Kick gave you a way to tell a very, 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 very important piece of history. It's a great personal story. I mean, you couldn't make up a more dramatic story than Kick's personal story, but it's also a tremendously important piece of history. And I think that was something that was made clear to me because of the way that this book was done. I went in to this world originally to research the president's story. And I found myself talking to people who were the key players in Kick's story. They were still alive. I really started this in about 2002. They were still alive and very, very, very eager to talk. People like the woman who actually inherited Kick's life, Debo Devonshire, the Duchess of Devonshire, who probably some of your listeners know better as the last of the Mitford sisters. And Debo became the Duchess because Kick died. I couldn't have written this book without her. I mean, she was unbelievably wonderful. And her husband, Andrew, who was the 11th Duke of Devonshire, both of them were still alive, and both Andrew and Debo, who became people that I knew well, were very, very clear to me that, you know, they saw themselves as trustees of history. They saw themselves as not just, I mean, they came from a family which had been one of the great players in British history, and they saw themselves as obligated to pass that history on. And so working with them and working with this book was just, I can't say unbelievably easy, but I was given a trust, and it doesn't usually happen to a historian or a biographer. It was just an extraordinary experience, the
right
whole thing, from beginning to end.
And you say in the acknowledgments that had you come to the story now, in 2016, it would have been too late, because some of these really crucial players in Kick Kennedy's story would no longer have been around for you to talk to. So it is so propitious that you began this work when you did, when some of these really important people were still available to you, and as you said, eager more than willing to talk to you.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. If I'd started 4 years ago, it was too late, and it was something that they kept reminding me of. I mean, I had an extraordinary experience. Once I was within what they called the cousinhood. Once the cousinhood was talking, and this is a world where cousins marry cousins, and the cousins pass you on to each other. And once I was within the cousinhood and talking to them, one of the people who I talked to at great length and who became somebody I adored and knew really, really well, was a woman called Jean Lloyd, Lady Lloyd, or as she was when Kick knew her, Jean Ogilvy, the daughter of the Duke of the Earl of Airlie. And Jean had been a little girl at the time that Kick arrived in England, and she had been assigned by Nancy Astor to introduce Kick to this world that was completely foreign to her. I mean, the aristocracy has incredible rules and rituals and relationships and who's married to whom and who is the cousin of this one and who hates this one and who loves this one. It's you can't navigate it by yourself if you weren't born into it. And so Jean had guided Kick through this world. And what was extraordinary for me was that Jean was still very much alive, and she did the same thing with me. And so as a result, I mean, I remember sitting with Jean, and she found her daily diaries of the Kick years. And she'd go through it, you know, page by page, and she'd say, now we were at this party. Now let me explain to you why this was not such a great party, or why this cousin was not here because he wouldn't have been invited to this. And I came away from it eventually feeling the world in a way that I could never have done, and I almost felt it. I mean, I was able to recreate the feeling that Kick must have had as she entered it. It was just an unbelievably lucky piece of timing, and the generosity of the people involved was extraordinary.
Right.
And of course, part of it was that they had also ended up so much thinking about Kick. I mean, they've been talking about her for 50 years by the time I got there.
You say at the very opening of the acknowledgments, Kick's story is the story of a vanished world. And you do indeed bring that thrillingly to life. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Barbara Leeming, a best-selling author many times over. Her latest book is called Kick Kennedy, The Charmed Life and Tragic Death of the Favorite Kennedy Daughter. By the way, I don't remember if I saw it anywhere in your book. Do we know anything about the origins of that nickname of Kick? Of who coined it and exactly when?
That is one of the mysteries. One of Kick's friends from early childhood said that the best explanation was that she had this kind of exuberant and irrepressible nature, and that somehow the kids had made up this nickname for that. But there are all kinds of other stories, but I think that basically does hit it. And nobody ever referred to Kick as anything except Kick. And I think, it's what you think. It's about her liveliness. I mean, she's an interesting character because you people kept saying to me, well, you know, why did these people want her? Why were they so attracted to her? And part of it was the simple explanation that she was just such a life force, and she was so different from, in, you know, this world where everybody's the same. Everybody, they've all read the same books, they've all talked to the same people, and they're very and very, very, very inbred. I mean, as fascinating and as cultured as and cultivated as some of them are, there's a sameness to it, and Kick came into that world and was different. But I think what I realized after talking to the survivors over the course of years is that the explanation for Kick's attraction is a little bit more complicated than that. You say, why did they want... Well, Kick literally was the granddaughter of a Boston saloon keeper. Why did they want her? And what I realized or learned eventually was that one of the reasons that they wanted her was because in the particular families that she married into, the two great Protestant families, because Billy Hardington, the boy that she ended up marrying, the Marquess of Hardington, was the heir to the Duke of Devonshire. He was also related to the other great family, the Cecils, who Queen Victoria's three-time prime minister. And those two families, and particularly the Cecils, had a tradition of when the dynasty began to be too inbred and began to weaken, they would go outside and look for literally fresh blood. I mean, this is blue blood looking for red blood. And they would go to something and marry, like, the grocer's daughter is one of the things they did. Well, when Kick came in, she and they realized somebody who was not just charming, which she certainly was, and not just lively, but she was tough. She could, she was competitive. She was strong in a way that they felt their families needed. They needed an injection of something fresh. And at that point, also, we have to remember that Joe Kennedy, who became a very hated figure in the course of the war, was very much not that. He was very popular when he first got there. They thought he was enormously funny, and he had the same, you know, same views as they did, because they were trying to avoid the war. They were, most of the family were involved in appeasing, and it was something that Joe fit into, but it went very, very badly. But I think the toughness and the competitiveness, they saw Kick as red blood, and I think that's a very important thing. And that's, again, one of the things that I could never have understood if I couldn't talk to these people. I mean, they had to explain what the family's histories were and what their rules were. Mm. And that was one of the things that I thought was very, very important to understand about Kick.
Right. One of the things you mention as the book opens is that when Kick first arrived in London with her parents, it was her and her four younger siblings.
Yes.
So, in other words, Joe Jr. wasn't there and Jack wasn't there.
Yes.
And so, as you describe it, so much of the publicity that attended the Kennedys' initial emergence in London focused on her.
Yes.
And how big a difference do you think that makes in how this whole story played out? I mean, if on the other hand, from the start, there had been Handsome Joe Jr. and Handsome Jack Kennedy also on the scene, might Kick Kennedy have been sort of relegated to the background and never emerged as she did? I suppose it's hard to surmise that sort of what-if scenario, but what's your best guess?
It's a really interesting question, and I can give you the answer, because it's quite funny. I mean, Joe Jr., who was at that point still very much, you know, the father was pushing Joe Jr. He was going to be the future president. And when Joe Jr. arrived, the young girls used to refer to him as the big one, because he was just bigger and fuller than the boys that they were used to, and he was also too aggressive, and they were sort of frightened of him. He didn't go down all that well. Some of them thought that, yes, he was interesting because he was going to be the power player, but Joe Jr. was not quite so popular. Jack, on the other hand, when Jack arrived, had he arrived a little earlier, he was not yet completely formed as Jack. He was a charmer, but he was still playing the game of being the sort of messed up son. He was pushing his way forward, but doing it very secretly because his father wanted Joe. And I remember Debo saying that when she met Jack the first time, she danced with him at a party, and she said, "Oh, he's very nice, but slightly boring." And I think at that point, strangely enough, Kick was the one who dazzled everybody. I mean, she was, and it was very strange for Jack, obviously, and you can see it in the letters back and forth between the two of them, you know, when he's in America and he's in the South Pacific and she's here. You can see Jack is sort of startled that this has happened, because when they were in America, Kick had been Jack's mascot. She had been the younger sister who he adored and who was dragged around with all of Jack's clack, and he had a clack. And Kick, suddenly he arrives in England, and Kick is the star, and he's following behind her. But that had huge historical impact, because after Kick had married into this family, and after her husband was dead, and after she was dead, the ties between the Devonshires and the Kennedys did not die out. Jack remained their kind of honorary American cousin, and when Jack was president of the United States, suddenly he found the prime minister of England, who was then Harold Macmillan, was his sort of uncle by marriage, Uncle Harold. And more important, too, was the ambassador to the United States was a man called David Ormsby Gore, who was raised as the brother of Kick's late husband, Billy. And suddenly, McMillan and David Ormsby Gore are family to Jack Kennedy, the President of the United States. And that changed very much the way that Jack ran his presidency, particularly David, who, I mean, Jack said, was next to, you know, along with Bobby, his most trusted advisor, and he called David the smartest man that he ever met. And David, without David, believe me, the Kennedy presidency would have been very, very, very different. And that came, that was the legacy of Kick. There was a literal legacy of that, because it held on because of that.
We're speaking with Barbara Leeming about her book, Kick Kennedy, The Charmed Life and Tragic Death of the Favorite Kennedy Daughter. We're talking about the oldest of the Kennedy daughters, Kathleen Kick Kennedy, who sadly was killed in a plane crash not long after the end of the Second World War. And she herself lost her husband, killed by a sniper during the war. We meet her in the course of your book, as she bursts on the sort of London scene in such dazzling fashion. And you obviously consider a really important matter, because you talk about it so much, the fact that she was, as you describe, a strangely blended character. And you say her personal contradictions were of immense appeal to the boys in this sort of world in which she was traveling. Talk about at least a couple of the most sort of interesting or intriguing contradictions in Kick Kennedy's style and personality that helped to make her a truly unique human being and such an attractive figure as well.
That's exactly the way that they thought of her. I mean, on the one hand, Kick was somebody, these girls that she suddenly found herself with had just come from the country, most of them. They came chaperoned. They had had no experience of boys. They were terrified. They're being brought in to literally for a marriage market to find a husband. And they're brought down from Scotland, or they're brought down from someplace in the country in England, and they haven't been around boys. And so what they did was they froze, most of them. Most of them had no conversation. Kick, on the other hand, had been with Jack, and she'd been at the dinner table when the Kennedys discussed politics. One of the things that made her a great star was that she loved listening to the political conversations and taking part in them, whether she knew what she was talking about or not. But a lot of the time she did, because it happened that the things that Jack was interested in were the things that these boys were interested in. The question of whether or not the boys were going to fight if there was a war, what was going to happen with all this. And so suddenly these English boys said, oh my God, this is unbelievable. We've got a girl who wants to talk politics. We love this. Plus, which she was just a talker in general, and she could laugh at herself. These girls were very, very nervous. They you know, if somebody made a joke at their expense, they didn't know how to respond. Kick laughed at herself. She'd initiate say, you know, listen to how ridiculous my accent is, or look at my legs, they're too fat. I mean, she was laughing at herself, and they weren't used to that. But then I think that one of the things that was very important to understand was that she was very, very innocent. I mean, she was a very good little Catholic girl, and these boys, who later, I mean, were quite different, were also quite innocent. And I think if they had been really confronted with, you know, a wild modern girl, they wouldn't have been able to handle it. They didn't want that. And so Kick was this absolutely perfect balance for them of innocence and experience, and she just fit right in. And the other thing I think that was interesting, at least initially, but then that changed, was that in this group, the boys were waiting to die. The boys in her set did expect to fight, and they expected that war was coming, and they expected that in that war, just as in the First World War, when the aristocracy was just savaged, they thought that they would probably die. The girls, on the other hand, didn't. They just weren't aware, until, you know, very late. And so they're thinking about parties, but Kick would sort of talk about the things, that the political things that really did concern these boys. And I think that was, you know, that was very, very important. And then, of course, the sad moment comes when Kick fell madly in love with one of the boys who was certainly going to fight. And suddenly you see she doesn't want to discuss politics anymore. She doesn't want to hear anything more about it because she doesn't want to hear that war is coming and she may lose him. And so it's a really interesting trajectory as you see time changing and as you see the war getting closer and closer. I mean, she did literally arrive with her father just after, you know, the onslaught, after the invasion of Austria. And from that moment on, you know, you're really running towards war, and she was feeling it. Her story was caught up in that war.
I appreciate how you frame this, the sort of atmosphere of the moment. At one point you write, "Since the time of the Rhineland invasion, the boys in this group had been persuaded that war was inevitable, despite anything that certain of their parents might say and insist. That expectation infused the boys' lives with a special intensity, never doubting that before long they would be called upon to fight and perhaps to die. They believed that they were entitled to enjoy themselves in the precious months and years that remained to them." And when you think about that being sort of the tenor of the moment, it makes great sense that if somebody as vibrant and interesting as Kick Kennedy steps into the picture, she would be of great interest to them. On the other hand, you tell us in the second chapter of the book about a very unhappy experience which she had at the so-called Hatfield House, in which she is the victim of some rather mean-spirited pranks, which speak about another reality with which she had to contend. Tell our listeners about this.
Yeah, the scene at Hatfield House is very interesting, because I had heard about this for a long time. I mean, Kick went, this is soon after she arrived, and she was invited to a house party at Hatfield House, which is the family home of the Salisburys, the Sissels, where she was subjected to these really nasty pranks. I mean, they'd take her shoes and hide them all. They short-sheeted her bed. I mean, they were just going at her, and she didn't understand it, and she's clearly very, very upset by it. And that's what I was referring to earlier. When I started to discuss this with the people who had been there, had been literally there at Hatfield, they said to me, no, this is, they were testing her. And what was so weird about it was that it was being instigated by the adults in the room. And it was literally a kind of test. How is this girl going to react? And when they saw how she reacted, that, yeah, she was upset, but boy, she didn't show them she was upset. She took herself down to dinner with two mismatched shoes. She didn't cry. She didn't go and plead with somebody to stop it. She just took it. And from that moment on, they saw her as somebody who was really a kind of rare bird. I mean, that she could reinfuse this blood. And so the Hatfield House weekend is enormously, enormously important. And I think it's one of those things that, again, is why I say I had to have the players in the story, because if you just tell that as a story the way that you would if you just read her letters or her diary or you heard it recounted, you'd think, oh, this is a silly story, what, you know, or nasty at best, what difference did it make? But no, in fact, it was an enormous testing ground, and everything changed after that. It's one of those things that you can't sort of believe happened, but it did. Hmm. It very much happened, and I think had that weekend gone a different way, they would have been more skeptical about Kick. I mean, it was only much, much, much later, after she had actually married Billy, that his father realized, oh, not only is she fresh blood, but she's a real political talent, because the moment they sent her out and started to have her speaking in Billy's absence, she was this tremendous success. I remember I had a letter from a woman who had seen Kick speaking in the marketplace during the war, and she wrote to me, and she still remembered it all these years later. She made quite an impression as a future political mover and shaker for them, but that was much, much later. It was the original thing was these sort of very cruel testing of her, and she passed.
You were able to speak with the younger brother of Billy, and Andrew's description of the relationship between Billy and Kick, you say, is maybe the best description of what made that relationship work. You quote Andrew Cavendish as saying, "It was difficult for each to imagine the existence of the other. They were so utterly different. They adored being with one another because each was a constant surprise to the other. What were they going to find out about this person? What was this person going to do next?" I think that is just fascinating because it flies in the face of what we often think of more simplistically as chemistry between two people being more based on shared interests and similarities. And this seems to have been a relationship that obviously had common bonds and similarities woven into it. But it, as far as Andrew was concerned, it was as much about the differences as anything that made them so attracted to one another.
I think that was fascinating. I remember when Andrew said that to me. First of all, I promised the readers that they will love Andrew. I mean, Andrew is irresistible, but he's also heartbreaking. But Andrew was incredibly smart. I mean, unbelievably smart. And his life was changed forever when his brother died, and he never expected to have the life that he had. I mean, he didn't expect to be Duke, and it was also. I mean, Andrew said to me, "I lived my life by proxy." That's not a nice way to think of yourself. I mean, he felt guilty for living his brother's life, and he never recovered from it. But he was so smart, and when he started to talk about the two of them as complete opposites, it began to make tremendous sense to me. They were fascinated. It was exciting, and they saw it as exciting. They were. I think the thing that held them together was that they were both talkers. They loved talking. I remember Jean saying to me and Andrew that when Billy was preparing for a conversation, he'd start rubbing his hands together. He was so excited, "We're going to talk." And this is a family of famous talkers. Conversation is the most important thing to them. I mean, Billy's sister Anne said to me, "You know, my mother once fired a governess because the governess rushed us down to dinner when we were in the middle of a conversation, thinking that the dinner timing was more important than the conversation." And my mother thought, "We don't want this woman around." I mean, conversation was everything to this family. And someone like Andrew, I mean, Andrew talks so fast that you half the time you couldn't understand him. Actually, one of the reasons Andrew and I got along, I think, was because we both talk fast. But Billy was not. Billy loved conversation, but he spoke slowly. He did not speak the same way as Andrew did. Andrew did Sissel speak. But Andrew's perceptions of things were tremendously interesting. He was somebody who was never without a book in his hand. And, of course, the great tragedy was when I knew Andrew, he was nearly completely blind. And for somebody who's a great, great, great reader, that's the worst thing that can possibly happen. And I can remember sitting in the library with Andrew, and all these books are around, and Andrew knew where every single book was, but he couldn't see them anymore. And yet he said to me, "Well, I guess if I had to lose one sense, I guess I would rather it still be my sight because I can remember the things, but I couldn't live without music." And he was feeding himself off music at that point. But it was, you know, it was heartbreaking to sit there in the room with just books every place, and he could no longer read. He'd sit with a jeweler's loop and look at things, but his sight was almost entirely gone. I mean, it was really very sad, but he was just an amazing, amazing person. I adored him.
One of the stories here is of a difference in religion. Kit Kennedy, of course, was Catholic, and Billy was not. And they each cared deeply about their own religions. In the case of Billy, he cared about being his own Protestant faith, cared about it for a couple of different reasons. And when it came time for the two to be married and for a choice to be made, Billy had to be absolutely insistent that Kick was the one who would compromise when it came to this. Explain to our listeners why this was such a crucial matter and the kind of difficulty that it created. I mean, a real challenge that had to be surmounted.
Yeah, it was very, very difficult for both of them. And for Billy, I think the thing, I mean, his sisters explained that to me, I remember, in a sort of very simple way. First of all, they said that the Duke, Billy was going to be the Duke eventually. He was going to be the Duke of Devonshire. And that's, as one of the great Protestant families, he would be appointing the clergy on the estates. I mean, they have grand estates. And that he had numerous clergy that he would actually appoint. Now, he said, if my children are going to be raised as Roman Catholics, which Kick wanted, if they're going to be raised as Roman Catholics, how are they going to appoint Protestant clergy? They can't do this. It's impossible to think of it. And it does obviously make sense. But also because their families were so involved in the break from the Roman Church, and it was such an essential part of their history that Billy felt that he had duty. He was somebody for whom duty was of enormous, enormous importance, and part of that duty was to honor the family's history in terms of religion. And on the other hand, he believed that Kick was very sincere in her religion, and he agonized over asking her to do something that he knew was going to be terribly, terribly hard for her. And it was one of the reasons he waited for a very long time to actually say, look, if we're going to do it, if we're going to marry, you're the one who's going to have make this break. And then on the other side, for Kick, I think there were two problems. First of all, because she did, as you said, she really sincerely had been brought up as a Roman Catholic. She believed it. Her religion meant a huge amount to her. But also there was the complication that in the Kennedy family, Kick was the one who was closest to her mother. And she was the one, not just closest to her mother, but she was her mother's protector. And I remember somebody telling me a story about Kick at the Cape when she was, before she went to England, when she was just a young teenager. And as we know, Joe Kennedy was a horrible philanderer. And they were sitting at the lunch table at the Cape, and Joe did something that he did apparently quite a lot. He brought one of his mistresses to the table when Rose was sitting there. And it was Kick who stood up and objected to her father, you know, you should not do this in front of mummy. This is really bad. And the boys just sat there. This was all fine as far as they were concerned. Kick was the one who, when they would laugh at their mother, she was the one who stood up for her. And she knew that if she married Billy, married a Protestant, this was going to break her mother's heart. And also, she also knew, I think, that that Rose's religion was the thing that kept her protected in a very, very difficult marriage, in a really difficult marriage. It enabled her to hide in that religion, and she understood the impact this was going to have. So I think that it was heartbreaking for her to have to hurt her mother, and she did, and that was never entirely repaired. And in fact, of course, it got much worse, because after Billy died, Kick recovered eventually and fell in love with another Protestant, but unfortunately a very different kind of Protestant. She fell in love with a married man, and a married man who was rather Peter Wentworth Fitzwilliam, the 8th Earl Fitzwilliam, who is fabulously wealthy and a great rival of the Devonshire family, but a very dissipated man, and it was not going good places. And Kick seemed absolutely blind. Nobody could warn her. She would listen to no one. And Rose, when she found out, she couldn't believe this. But I think in addition to Rose not believing it and saying you'll never see any member of this family again, I think for Kick, the second attempt was also something that she was never able really to reconcile with her own religious beliefs. I think in the case of the divorced man, that was something she didn't ever really feel was right, no matter how much she thought she was in love with him. And she was actually in the process, as you know, of trying to go to her father in Paris with Peter to see if Joe could put a fix in somehow and find a way for them to marry within the church, and that was never going to happen. And when they were on the way to see Joe, they were in a terrible plane crash, and both Kick and Peter Fitzwilliam were killed instantly, and this is in 1948 when she was only 28 years old. So it's a sad, it ends in a very sad, in a very, very sad way. Very, you know, really, it's about as tragic as you can get.
Right. You mentioned the fact that she is buried there, not here in America. And you imply, as you kind of describe the accident which killed her and where she was buried and under those circumstances, how that might at least be one reason why Kick Kennedy is not better remembered in this country, that is perhaps one factor in why she is as obscure a figure as she is, even for people who know something about the Kennedy family.
Yeah, it was something that the Kennedys certainly tried to hide. They didn't want anybody to know that she was involved with Peter Fitzwilliam, and so the stories were concocted that she had just happened to hitch a ride with him on the way, you know, and as best they could, they wanted to forget this. And the mark of just how horrendous this was for them was that when Kick died, her body was lying in Paris. Joe identified the body, but he was just shattered and didn't do anything. Rose didn't do anything. Jack didn't do anything. Suddenly, this girl is lying there, and somebody's got to do something. And Billy's mother, who Mousher Devonshire, who was then the Duchess of Devonshire, who adored Kick and who was just the most wonderful human being, Mousher said, "Please, if it's all right with you, can we bury her here as Billy's wife? And we loved her, and she should be here, and this is where we would, if it's all right with you, can we do it?" And not only did they do it, but for the Devonshires to do it the way they did it as exactly the way the Catholic Church wanted it done, and that's, you know, that was not easy for them to even think about it, but all they cared about was taking care of her. And so Kick is buried in the little village overlooking Chatsworth, and the last time I talked to Debo Devonshire about Kick, this was after Andrew was dead, and we were sitting there in her garden because she had moved out of Chatsworth after her husband died. The dowager always has to move out. She was living in the little village just a few feet away from Kick's grave, and Debo and I were sitting there, I remember, on a swing in the garden, and Kick was right there, and we were talking about her. And Debo said to me, "You know, Barbara, you know, we've given you this enormous gift. I mean, in talking to you about this, and we trusted you. And this had been going on for years." And she said, "If you don't write it now, it's got to get done. You're not going to do it." And I guess I felt Kick there, and I finally realized, you know, I really do have to sit down. The time is now, and it has to be done. And you know, thank goodness that I did do it, and thank goodness she pushed me in the way that she did, because she thought it was a history that shouldn't be lost, and it was a great and enormous gift, and I hope in some way I've honored that trust.
I certainly think you do, and I know lots of other people do as well. It's a tremendously important and valuable story for us to explore. The book again is called Kick Kennedy, The Charmed Life and Tragic Death of the Favorite Kennedy Daughter, published by Thomas Dunn, a division of St. Martin's Press, and the author, Barbara Leeming. Barbara Leeming, thank you so much for writing this wonderful book and for being so generous in your time and talking about it with me today on The Morning Show. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg. You've just been absolutely wonderful. Thank you a million for inviting me.
And in the couple of minutes that remain in this hour, I want to share with you two moments from the book Kick Kennedy that I find especially moving. One is an excerpt from one of the last letters that Billy wrote to his young wife. His letter to her from Gilberville was one that she would reread many times again. He wrote, I have been spending a lovely hour on the ground and thinking in a nice, vague, sleepy way about you and what a lot I've got to look forward to if I come through this all right. I feel I may talk about it for the moment as if I'm not in danger, so I'll just say that if anything should happen to me, I shall be wanting you to try to isolate our life together, to face its finish, and to start a new one as soon as you feel you can. I hope that you will marry again, quite soon, someone good and nice. And author Barbara Leeming goes on to say, so there it was. He had said the unsaleable. Billy knew by this time that survival was going to be all about luck, and that luck was unpredictable. Sadly, his luck proved to be bad luck, and he was cut down by a sniper's bullet, killed instantly by a bullet to the head. His mother drafted an emotional letter to her daughter-in-law, telling Kick about what had happened to Billy, and assuring her that she would always be a cherished member of her late husband's family. She writes, I want you never, never to forget what complete happiness you gave him, the Duchess wrote to Kick. All your life you must think that you brought complete happiness to one person. He wrote that to me when he went to the front. I want you to know this, for I know what great conscientious struggles you went through before you married Billy. But I know that it will be a source of infinite consolation to you now that you decided as you did. All your life I shall love you, not only for yourself, but that you gave such perfect happiness to my son, whom I loved above anything in the world. An excerpt from Barbara Leeming's book, Kick Kennedy, The Charmed Life and Tragic Death of the Favorite Kennedy Daughter. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'll be speaking with Roger Ferris, who is the author of a brand new best-selling book called The Arm. It explores the special rigors that and damage that is so often done to the throwing arms of pitchers, certainly major league pitchers, professional baseball pitchers, but also for pitchers at every level of the game. We are starting to see more and more very serious elbow injuries, even to some very young pitchers, and more pitchers undergoing what is known as Tommy John surgery. And Roger Ferris explores all of this in his very, very interesting book, again called The Arm. On Wednesday's program, I speak with Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clawson Center at Carthage College. He'll be paying his monthly visit to the program and to offer his analysis of current events. We will be talking with him, of course, about the presidential primary, which will have just been waged in the state of New York. I'm also going to be asking Professor Sear to talk about a gigantic company in China that very few of us have heard of, but it actually rivals Amazon in size and scope and influence. We'll talk about a lot of other things as well, including updates on the serious earthquakes experienced in both Japan and Ecuador. That's Art Sear on Wednesday's program. And then on Thursday and Friday, a two-part program with author Wendy Paris, the author of a fascinating new book called Splittopia, which explores some of the ways in which divorce is something that can be a positive experience and sometimes lead to new chapters that are much happier than the marriage itself. And she offers also a lot of very good suggestions on how a positive, healing divorce can be achieved. So we'll be hearing from her on both Thursday and Friday's morning shows. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find the program archived right on the front page of WGTD's website, which is WGTD.org. From WGTD's community calendar,